You became interested in this very secretive Mexican tribe of runners after you had experienced some injuries yourself.
You know, I thought that is normal. I would try to run a little bit. I mean a little bit. If I ate too much pizza on Sunday, I'd try and like jog a little bit on Monday. So I wasn't a competitive runner. I was just a normal recreational jogger, and I was constantly getting injured. And because I'm a big guy, you know, I'm 6'4" at the time, I was around 240 pounds, I would go to see doctors, and they'd say, well, you know, what do you expect? Running's not good for the body, especially not bodies the size of like a walk-in fridge. And so, of course, you're getting hurt. So I took that as the normal thing. And then when you research it a little bit, you know, ironically at the time, I was a writer for Runner's World magazine. So I was really familiar with the fact that everybody got injured, that the injury rate was above 50%. So I kind of gave up on it. I figured, well, you know, you can't run, you can't run. But, of course, there is that deviling irony there, which is that if you are heavy, you're told to run, but if you run, you get told you'll be hurt because you're heavy. So what's the way out? And that's when I heard about the Tarahumara. I hear about this tribe in Mexico, and these guys are running like super long distances, 100, 200 miles at a time, and they're still doing it at 70, 80 years old. So my question is, well, how come we all get hurt and these guys don't?
I am somebody who relies on my GPS on my phone to get me to the new restaurant on the edge of town. And in your book, you describe finding the, I'm not going to pronounce it as well as you, Tarahumara?
Very good, yeah.
Okay. And yet you were able to find this tribe. Yes, you had a guide, but nonetheless, you, and then there's also a character, Scruffy, or the white horse.
Yeah.
Who also was able to find this tribe that really is known for secrecy. Can you?
Yes. Well, if it's up to me, I wouldn't have found anybody. I had no idea where I was going, where to start, no idea whatsoever. And I just started asking around. And, you know, it's like sort of what it's like being a freelance journalist is you smell a juicy story and you just kind of sort it out because there's a paycheck at the end of the trail. So I just started asking around. And eventually I heard about a guy who was the brother of a guy who every year would go down in the canyons and bring, like, pencils and school books to the Tarahumara children. So the brother of the guy thought he pretty much knew where to go. Like, that was the strength of my guidance. But it turned out he was right. You know, this guy Salvador was able to eventually get us down to this Tarahumara settlement. And it was there we discovered two things. Number one, the Tarahumara remain a reclusive tribe by, like, not answering questions when strangers show up, so they were not going to talk to me. However, someone had beaten us to the punch. Another guy had shown up about 15 years earlier and had been down there ever since, a guy they called the White Horse. So that began the next leg of the adventure, which was trying to track down the White Horse and see if he could tell us really what the secret of the Tarahumara's great distance running ability was.
And for those individuals who have not read Born to Run, it's a complex answer and yet also a simple one. What is the secret of this tribe?
You know, you're right. It is a simple answer. And I think what it really lies in is that, you know, we've developed this sense over time that we are these, like, sort of fragile creatures that, you know, we need bike helmets and, like, special foods. We have to be told what to eat, and we have to be told what to wear, and that human beings are just like these, like, eggshells, always on the verge of breaking. I know that's kind of ironic speaking about that to you right now, Amanda, with your broken wrist, but, you know, the fact is that we are really strong, resilient, adaptable creatures, that for most of our existence, we were, like, naked in the wilderness. We were not living in homes. We were out there on the African savanna struggling to survive. And the one weapon that early humans had, which made us competitive in a wild world, was our ability to run long distances. Like, that's it. Compared to other creatures, we've got nothing. We're not strong. We're not fast. We can't swim very well. We can't fly. We don't have fangs. We don't have claws. We don't have anything. But the one thing we can do, which no other creature can do very well, is to vent heat on a hot day. Because most land-based mammals vent heat by respiration. They pant like a dog. They pant like a racehorse. Mm-hmm. What humans do, though, is we perspire. And we vent our heat primarily by perspiration, which means that on a hot day, if you're chasing a deer across the African savanna, after about an hour, that deer is going to do one of two things. Either it's going to suck in oxygen or it's going to vent heat. But it's not going to do both at the same time. But we can. And that's the reason why we can run ultramarathons across Death Valley in July. But an antelope can never do that. And that was it. So essentially, our natural ability is to run long distances. I think that we have strayed from that natural legacy by, unfortunately, running has become marketed as this dangerous thing that you need special shoes and special clothes and special training. And we treat it like it's this health hazard as opposed to this natural ability.
A natural ability and also a natural love. The Tarahumara's people, they love running. It's more than just, this is the technique, go win a race. It is instinct and therefore leads to some sort of sublime joy.
Right, and you said the key words there, go win a race. And that's a difficulty. I think in sort of Puritan America, we are uncomfortable to admit that we're doing anything for fun. Like when you go to the gym, what do you go? You go there to work out. It's a form of work.
And right. Lose weight.
Everyone loves to complain about how they're overworked and working to it. That's a point of pride. And you can't say, I'm just going to go mess around. You can't say that. No, it's got to be work. And we've done the same thing with running. We've taken what a five-year-old does for fun, and we can't admit that it's fun. So we got to pretend it's work. And so we got to run as fast as we can. And if you're on the treadmill, you're checking out what the other guy's doing, and everything is a competition. The Tarahumara don't run that way at all. In fact, they don't have individual champions. The only way the Tarahumara race is in teams. They are always running as a pack, where the fastest person is only as fast as the slowest person in the group. And, I think you probably know this from your own experience with the Springfield Roadrunners. I would have to guess that the most fun you've ever had running was probably with a gang of friends out having a run together. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Never a race.
Yeah, and a race is stressful, and you're up early, and did I put on the...
I always forget the safety pins.
Exactly, and you're in a corral 2 hours before you really want to be there, and then there's a line of porta-potties. So I think unfortunately what we've done is with running is we've taken the thing that every child does instinctively for pleasure, and we have turned it into a form of work to make our consciences feel better. And I think the real secret is if we just admit that it's fun, we'll all have a good time.
So what do you say when you have a very competitive runner? Do you participate in races anymore?
Oh, almost never. But again, it's sort of judge not lest you be judged. I got a friend who right now as we speak is training to make an attempt on the 12-hour treadmill record. He's going to try and run 77 miles on a treadmill in 12 hours. Yet, at the same time, this buddy of mine, Chris Solars, at the same time, when he runs the Boston Marathon, he can run a 2:40 marathon. But when he runs Boston, it takes him 6 hours because he's drinking beer and high-fiving and kissing and hugging. So Chris, I believe, is the perfect mix of run hard when you run hard, but have fun when you want to have fun. Because there's a lot of joy and pleasure from training hard, feeling yourself get stronger, feeling yourself get faster. But I think what you need to do is have that insight to realize when the pleasure meter is dipping the wrong direction. If you're training hard and it feels good and it's great, fine. On the other hand, if it becomes misery and you're just punishing yourself, then it's time to back off and reassess.
Your book is largely credited with kicking off the barefoot running craze. So when we see people walking down the street running or just going about running their errands in those Vibram five-toed shoes, people that maybe don't wear any shoes at all. I know of a woman who just put duct tape on her feet and that's how she'd go out for a jog. What do you think of that trend? Is that getting to the heart and the root of what the Tarahumara have long worn on their feet and kind of their secret in terms of just these leather strap sandals? Or is this just another form of commercialization of something that is so innate it need not be there at all? And what do you run in?
I sort of use footwear the same way I use clothing. only as much as necessary. So if it's a warm day and I'm on the road somewhere, I'll go barefoot. But if I'm on a rocky trail, then I'll put on either a trail shoe or a pair of sandals. It's just kind of like looking at the golf bag and choosing what kind of club you need, as little club as possible. So I don't actually play golf, so I've got no idea if that analogy actually works. But
I don't either.
But the thing of the matter is, yes, you know, in the 1970s, we were sold a bill of goods that running is harmful and you need the right shoes and you have to have the pronation and the supination and the rest of that baloney. And what people have rediscovered is that for 2 million years, we got along just fine without running shoes. A little bit of protection on your foot can be a good thing, and that's why, you know, 1.5 million years ago, OT Man, as like a prehistoric man, was discovered with a pair of shoes on his feet, grass-made shoes. A little bit of protection is a good thing. Where we got into trouble was, as usual, when we thought we could outthink Mother Nature, and we went past protection, and we got into the market for correction. And so, like, the mad scientists at the shoe labs started creating all this crap, you know, these wedges and these, you know, anti-pronation devices where they were going to try and change the behavior of your foot. And I believe those things actually caused the injuries that we're dealing with. And so what people discovered is that, boy, you know, you take the shoes off, you relearn how your foot moves. Like, here's one simple example. Almost every shoe you ever put on is very narrow in the toe, you know, a very narrow toe box, and your toes are almost always neutralized in whatever kind of shoe you wear. Now, when you think about this, you don't have five toes by accident. They're not just there to be dangling off your feet to look pretty. They're there for a reason, because they actually help you balance and stabilize and change direction. So these very important appendages in most shoes are neutralized. So that's one of the benefits you get from taking off your shoes immediately, is your toes are now activated again. So I mean, I think it's a really healthy thing for people to just to understand how their feet work. And if they choose to put on some kind of protection afterwards, that's fine, but at least they know what the starting point is.
We are no longer oftentimes in a natural world. So if you're running along a street, somebody may have had a part of their car, you know, a tiny little metal bit fall off, and it could slice you, something that wasn't around at the time of our ancient ancestors and the cavemen and women.
You know, it's interesting because Barefoot Ted, who I tease a lot in the book and in life, he is a out-of-this-world character. But Barefoot Ted, regrettably, I keep finding myself quoting him, and Barefoot Ted will say something that I think is ridiculous, and then 2 years later I'll find out that I'm doing it myself. But Barefoot Ted has this great quote. He says, you know, the modern world is really safe. It's like nature you can look out for. Like, nature is where all, like, the surprises are. So if you're actually running down a street, the street is really smooth, it's clear, you can see what's there. There are almost no surprises on a city street. You see, when you got on a trail where there's like pine needles and rocks and all kind of burrs and things, that's when you get hurt. So, number one, it is astonishing how clean our city streets are. We have this perception, but when you actually take your shoes off, I've never been cut or hurt. I did a 9 mile run one time from Harlem to Brooklyn, right through downtown Manhattan. This is in August with a group of 70 people. Nobody got hurt. Nobody had a problem. But the second thing is, one benefit you get from running barefoot is you will instantly and immediately change the way you run. Most of us, when we run in shoes, are heel striking. We're sticking our foot way out in front of our body and landing on our heel. And when you run that way, you have basically committed yourself to that stride. Once you stick that foot out there, you've got to land on it, and you can't change direction. However, when you run barefoot, you're running on your midfoot or the ball of your foot, and your foot is directly underneath your center of balance, underneath your hips. So if you're on your left foot and you're about to step onto your right and you see that jagged piece of car stuff, you can just hop over it. You can just change direction. That's a benefit you get from barefoot running, which is that you become much more nimble.
You talked about the reclusive nature of the Tarahumara tribe, and yet they are the subject of this wildly popular book. I know as a journalist, there are times that I'm, you know, all about the story no matter what, And that's in part because part of my job is to report on politicians, you know, who are out there as very public figures. They're literally on a ballot and therefore the most public that you can get. But this tribe that wants to be secretive, wants to be primarily, you know, left alone, do their thing, has been burned before and therefore wants to keep to itself. Do you feel any responsibility to that tribe, or do you know, have there been others that have gone off, you know, trying to seek these individuals, live with them? Do you know at all? Have you kept in touch and about that sort of impact?
Oh, yeah. I've been in constant contact with people who are still intimately involved with the Tarahumara. And it was definitely a concern early on, but I felt pretty comfortable following the lead of Caballo Blanco, one of the main figures in the book. And the way he looked at it, again, nobody was more prickly and defensive about defending the rights of the Tarahumara than Caballo. And his outlook was, basically, something has to be done. This is a community in dire need, that they are surrounded by drug cartels, by lumber barons, that they're traditional hunting lands are being stripped away from them year by year, and that if something isn't done, if there isn't some kind of awareness, then this is a culture that is going to disappear within our lifetime. Response, and I still believe it was really kind of genius, was why take the champions away from their home court? Let's bring other people down to the home of the champions and let them not just run with the Tarahumara, but live with them and spend time with them. And that was really what the book Born to Run's all about. Was the first time that he pulled this off was when me and about seven other runners came down to the canyons to spend time hiking and living and running with the Tarahumara, and then culminated in this crazy 50-mile race. And I believe, like, you know, Caballo made his dream come true. Like, this is exactly what he wanted. He wanted outsiders to come down and realize that there is some really important ancient wisdom living down here in the canyons that we can all learn from. Now, what has happened subsequently is that Caballo's race has gone on. Caballo himself, unfortunately, passed away 2 years ago. But his girlfriend has done this sensational job of carrying on his legacy, and the race has just gotten bigger and bigger. So if the race or anything attached to it were harming the Tarahumara, the first people to get out of there would be the Tarahumara. And instead, they come back in ever-growing numbers every year for Caballo's race.
And what about, as you said, the drug cartels and the lumber barons? Has this made an impact in that regard? Is that just too big of an ask?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know how to measure it. I would be surprised if they're going to be scared off by anything like a bunch of, skinny runners in shorts. I don't think we're that much of an army. However, the one thing is, you know, if you want to affect change, number one is awareness and let people know that there's something down here worth protecting. And at least that goal has been achieved.
I just want to make sure that I'm not missing anything in terms of this story and the zen that it may have brought you in your life or in your running or individuals beyond, and kind of the lessons of this tribe. What am I missing?
I think your questions are dead on the money. They're excellent questions. And I think the key ones were what kind of harm or benefit has the book created? And secondly, is like, how come some of us love running and some of us don't? And I think you really hit those with the questions about racing and training and what's going on with the race now.
Out of curiosity, can you say what your next book is?
Yeah. I'm so close to finishing it. It is it's driving me crazy. It's looking at resistance fighters during World War II and trying to understand how physically they were able to pull off some of their exploits. Because, you know, you look at sort of like Hogan's Heroes. Hey, look at those guys. They're digging tunnels and they're running away. Try digging a tunnel. It's really hard. And running through the woods chased by Germans, really hard. So what I'm doing is looking at one particular adventure and breaking it down to kind of like the physiological parts and looking at, like, you know, what they were eating and how they were living and what kind of natural resources they're able to draw on that let them do things that most of us would consider impossible.
Well, I very much look forward to reading it. I know my mom is a big fan of The Amazing Race. And I'm not big on watching any TV whatsoever. But it is one of those things where some of the, whenever I'm home and she's got it on, there was one where, you know, they had to like drag blocks and make a pyramid. And it's the pyramid. I mean, there are so many amazing physical feats that I can't even fathom. Thinking of the idea, how to do it, let alone carrying it out, and then you see people just rise to the occasion, and it's really tremendous, but you want to know why.
That's exactly it, too. Again, we assume, oh, you have to do this, or I'm only this strong. And actually, no, if you actually just open your eyes and your mind to the possibilities of just doing it a different way, then suddenly there's all these like deep reservoirs of strength that we rarely tap into.
Well, thank you so much.